in, for those of us who are new in Parliament, it's a mission. You get lost many times. More on a serious note, honourable members, and I see we've got the media in our midst. You're welcome. Honourable Ambrosini, I know you love the reserve bench. This one is a meeting you can't miss. You're also welcome. Colleagues, you will recall that in our first interaction with the governor of the reserve bank, it was almost 10 days into her office, which was a demonstration on your part that Parliament is not just a democratic institution through which the voices of our people could be heard, but from your own understanding, it is also a center where the Reserve Bank as an institution, a very important institution, and a player in the economy, regulating the economy of our country, should find its voice also expressed. Because indeed we are an independent institution as the Parliament. We are the most and probably the voice that every electorate in South Africa can align with. And therefore when Parliament speaks, it speaks on behalf of the people of the country. But I would really want to thank you for bringing in a new approach on how the Reserve Bank should relate not only with Parliament. I've heard your comments so far, even with civil society, that you are open for engagement on a number of issues. We think this will help us to go a long way. I don't know if this kind of interaction has ever happened before, that immediately after the budget, the Reserve Bank comes to Parliament to give its own impressions. If it has happened, it's fine. But nonetheless, I think for us, it is a very, very good development that will take us forward in trying to analyze what we should do as Parliament. More so, given that Parliament has a new role in the budgetary process. Not that it's not a role, but this is the most interesting time in the sense that when the budget was presented last week and everybody was commenting about the budget, including the president later on, I did not hear anybody saying the presentation or the table of the budget is part of the process. It's not the end. It's not the beginning. It's just the beginning of the process also. Because Parliament, at the end of the day, would have to make that process to be a complete one. So, I guess it's something that we'll have to teach the entire society, business community, civil society, including ourselves, that the presentation and the table of the budget is not the end. The end is when the budget is passed by Parliament. And this committee is at the center of that work, and all other committees. We are now going to get a presentation from your good self and your team about how you see the budget, particularly within the context of fiscal framework. Thank you very much, and welcome to this important meeting.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for the opportunity. Let me start with an apology. There seem to have been a number of delays at OR Tambo this morning, so two colleagues are still on the way. One is in the traffic. The microphones don't stay today. One is in the traffic, and the plane was delayed for 1.5 hours. So they should be joining us, and if you don't mind, they'll just come straight in and sit down, but we can start anyway. We'll just reverse the orders of presentation to accommodate that, if that's acceptable to you. Obviously, you know, these things do happen, but unfortunately happen to two colleagues on two different planes, which is a little unusual as well. So if you'll accept, Dr. Mnyande and Daniel Mnyande, Deputy Governor, will be joining us during the process as soon as they land and come through. Second of all, Chair, just perhaps a slight difference in terms of the presentation. The approach that we take as a bank is really not as much to comment on the budget per se, but our responsibility would be to look at the economic framework within which this is taking place, so that when the committee evaluates what's being proposed in the budget, it's got the domestic and global context, so that we look at what is possible. So when you look at the budget, you look at the environment and what is possible. Just for yourself, perhaps, and it might be something that you do find useful, the Public Finance Division of the Reserve Bank, of the Research Department, has developed documents on Budget 2010 and on the tax issues. And we can leave that with you, which might just, in a way, it's lifted up the issues that they see as important or sort of a summary of that. So we can leave that with you just for reference if that might help you. But we can give that to you later. I think the context that we would like to start with is really, where are we now, 2010? First of all, in the global context, because what happens in the world actually is important, is very critical to the choices we can make and what is possible for us to do. And you do have the presentations before you that cover all of these things. So what I would like to do is perhaps just introduce that context for a start. In essence, what we're seeing is the international economy recovering. It's certainly been aided by the stimulatory packages that have been addressed. And I'll go into that in a little bit more in detail, recognizing how important that has been globally, and that a lot of the focus on what has happened in this crisis has been in the developed world, which of course is a very interesting question in itself, because if you look historically at crises, they tend over the recent periods to be much more in the developing economies, and the impact from this occurring in the developed world has very serious repercussions. So it's really a global recession of enormous proportions, and in many ways is regarded as the Great Recession, able to not enter a Great Depression, primarily through the coordinated action of governments and central banks around the world. So it's been a very, very serious situation. Economic activity is recovering. The IMF has raised its outlook for growth and for the potential for the world to grow. The details Brian will cover. But it's a very important question that it seems to be recovering faster than what was anticipated. And there is definitely improvement in secondary and tertiary sectors. The various short-term indicators also indicate, certainly in South Africa, are coming out of the recession reasonably rapidly, and I think there's a few of data that's coming out this week that will give us an indication of where the numbers lie, and that will be very helpful for us. What we've seen is one of the consequences of this global recession, both in the developed world and certainly in South Africa, is a very serious fall off in employment. Both, if you take, just to use one example, if you take the US, their formal employment is around 10%. Expectation is, depending on how growth occurs in the U.S., whether they think that will rise to 11% by the end of this year, because they do not see, they see growth, but not necessarily with jobs. If you take the wider measure, and that's why these comparisons are very difficult to have, in that you're not always comparing like with like. So what comprises a number in one country is not necessarily the same as what comprises another. If we take the wider definition in the U.S., it, unemployment stands at about 18%, but that would include people who've been discouraged or people who have had full-time jobs and are now on part-time. Morning, Wanda. And Dr. Monia Mnyande just had a difficult journey this morning. So if one had to look at that approach, the numbers are important. Now, if we take South Africa, South Africa has lost around 900,000 jobs by the wider definition, which includes informal sector. Now, when you compare that to other unemployment, we don't know whether the unemployment that you're comparing with and what the impact is on the different economies is a wider or narrow definition, what it includes. So you can't just make the assumptions that these match. But without any question, there has been huge impact on employment in all of these countries. Some with a lag, the UK and Europe, where you've had a job hoarding, where people, the companies have tried to retain their workers, with a compact that may or may not be formally agreed. So, for instance, you've retained the workforce in the UK, where unemployment is now at about 8%, but all new wage settlements, 2/3 of the wage settlements that are agreed are at 0%. So part of the retention has meant that workers have agreed to have no increases. So the job is more important than the increase. So 2/3 of employment of wage settlements have been at 0 in the UK, but much lower job losses. To look at a couple of things that I think are important for us to put into this context. So we're saying, in essence, it looks better, it looks as if it's recovering, the signals and the data are indicating that it is, but they're very serious warning lights. So it cannot be taken for granted that this will happen, and a lot of things mitigate in favor of, even if it is recovery, it's looked at as slow and over the medium term rather than a very quick recovery around the world. And I'm talking primarily around the developed world at the moment. If we look at, say, some of the numbers that I think are very useful, if you looked at the fiscal balances, and I'll just give you a number of countries on that, the U.S. in 2007 had a deficit of 2.8. That has risen in 2009 to 11.2. If you looked at their debt-GDP ratio, the U.S. in 2007 was at 62%. In 2010, it's expected to be 92%. If you take Japan as an example, our fiscal balance was 2.5% in 2007, which is their deficit, and in 2009 that had risen to 7.4%. If you looked at their debt-GDP ratio, it was 188% in 2007, and in 2010 it's expected to be 227% of GDP. Now, if you looked at that, how does a country come out of that debt level? It's just unbelievably huge. If you looked at South Africa, after our borrowing now, the estimate is we'll come in at about 40% of GDP. So a very good number, and we've had very low international borrowing, so you've got room to borrow. And that is one of the lessons of the crisis, is that if you were in a difficult state around deficits and GDP debt ratios, when you're hit by the crisis, you've got very little room to move. South Africa has moved from a surplus into a deficit and therefore can work its way back down because you're not starting off with a deficit. And secondly, its debt GDP numbers have been very good. So looking at it's different from household disposable income debt numbers, which have moved from 80% to about 79%. So South Africa is still a very highly indebted nation at the individual level. Perhaps just to use a couple of other countries, if you looked at Greece, what you are now calling pigs or peas, depends whether we include Italy or not. Italy now is surfacing within the peas. So if you looked, for example, at Greece, Its fiscal deficit moved from 3.7% in 2007 to 13% in 2009. Very similar to Ireland, to the US, huge numbers. UK is not far off that in terms of deficit. Its debt-GDP ratio was at 96%, welcome Daniel. Its debt-GDP ratio in 2007 was 96%, and expectations for 2011 is at 135%. Italy in the same category, debt-GDP ratio would be 123%. So this is a very big global risk in relation to where the deficits of the developed world have gone to and how this is worked out without major adjustments. And that's the challenge. If you take a Spain, which is twice the size, five times the size of Greece, Spain's unemployment is at 20%. Its deficit is very similar to these other countries. I think it's around 11%. If you're looking at what it has to do, it has no ability, being part of Euroland, similar with Greece, to devalue the currency because you're part of a common currency. And those are important lessons for South Africa if you want to peg your rand or you're talking about these things, to look at the tools that you then have are diminished when you're hit by these kinds of shocks. So part of the question would be, what adjustment would Spain have to make, which is then on the fiscal and the expenditure side, which means job losses, when you're already at a 20% unemployment. So what this indicates is that there's a lot of challenge and a lot of common purpose that needs to be developed to come out of these crises by the countries involved. A couple of other things that I would want to perhaps just mention in relation to the stimulus packages. If you looked at the estimates at the moment, the total global fiscal package has been about 3.2% of world GDP at around over $2 trillion. So a huge amount of money has been poured into the stimulus packages. Some of the big countries that have the big numbers, in fact, the biggest number of all has been China. Let's see if I can see the China number. China has, in fact, put in almost 7% of its GDP into a stimulus package. The actual billions of dollars is $586 billion. So China has recovered very quickly, and its growth expectation for this year is 10%. But it's been at the cost of huge stimulus package. If you looked at the Fed, the U.S. Fed, it's expanded the size of its balance sheet to from approximately $800 billion to over $2 trillion now. If you look at it's again the role of a central bank is that when you have difficult times, you've got to act in the interest of the economy of the country. And you do things that are not in the interest of your own balance sheet. You do things that are in the interest of the country that can be negative for your balance sheet. In terms of that, the U.S. fiscal stimulus, in fact, accounted for 3.5 percentage points of the 3% growth in 2009, which says that if there had not been a stimulus package, growth would have been negative in the U.S. Now, the stimulus is coming to an end, and we'd have to see what happens with that, and if there's been sufficient underlying recovery. In essence, if one looked at this, and again, one's totally really talking about the global situation, not the South African banks, and I want to repeat that, this is not the South African banking sector problem, but if you look at global banking losses, that is realized and lost provisions, it stands at about $2.8 trillion. And only half of that has already been realized. So if we have to look at it, you're then looking at banks that have had to recapitalize, and the recapitalization has been at about $1.5 trillion. So if one had to look at the scale of the numbers that involve this crisis, and why that's important for us, because if you use this amount of resource to keep the world economy afloat, you've got to work your way out of it. And that in itself would be a huge challenge. And I think, Chair, that in terms of the context in which you operate, it's really important for South Africa, for its policies and for what it can do, is to understand and appreciate fully just what's happening in the world around, because what happens here will influence or impact on what you can export to whom, what happens to commodity prices, all of those kind of things. So it's an appreciation of the scale of what this this crisis has actually meant, and the ability to work your way out of it, which requires, as to the best that you can have, coordination between fiscal and monetary policy, and coordination across boundaries between the different countries' fiscal and monetary policy. Because you can't, or if you look at it, it's so interconnected that if you have policies in one country that have a huge impact on others that are at variance with what's needed, you find you have a very difficult situation. So, as we're indicating, definitely an improved outlook with big risks. And perhaps just the one question that I would suggest stays on the horizon, but it's something that, again, it's just in a way for us a watching approach, is that there's a paper, there are two papers that might be interesting for the committee. The IMF has put out two papers, both by the same person, Olivia Blanchard, which is looking at, he's the chief economist at the Peterson Institute of Economics, and we can give you the references if you like. But he has a presentation on what the adjustment would be, the adjustment required for the developed countries to come out of this. And he finds that in essence, it requires more than a 10% of GDP fiscal adjustment for Greece, Ireland, Japan, United States, UK, and Spain would be required to come out of the IMF. Now, that coming out of the IMF, which is usually very conservative and cautious about the numbers, I think this is a huge number for those countries and what it means. And then, of course, it becomes a question that because normally a country in that circumstance would devalue its currency because they're part of Euro, they can't. So the tools come from the fiscal side, and that has implications for expenditure and obviously then on jobs. So that's the environment that we're in. And I'm not dealing with the South African environment at the moment, we're going to come to that now. But I just think that that's the global context in which South Africa is working, which is, as I said very clearly, it's an improved outlook. Definitely an improved outlook. Numbers reveal revising upwards. Every revision the IMF has made at the moment has been up. It's a consensus forecast of below the private or country forecast. But it is definitely looking at an improved environment, notwithstanding that these are the risks on the horizon. And why does one point out that? It's because you can't take it for granted. You can't think we're out and therefore all of these things just fall into place. This is a lot of hard work still to come and a lot of pain still to come out of what has been experienced over the last 2.5 years. So with that, I would really like to hand over to you. So what we would then do is hand over to the domestic side, which Mondi will do, Marcus, Daniel, and then the monetary policy side, which would be Brian. And then we can perhaps, I don't know if you'd like to open for questions at the end and do each presentation, or questions to each presentation, at least for clarity, and then we can have a full discussion. But we'll be guided by you, Chair.
I guess a presentation is a topic on its own. But because of time, I would rather take perhaps two presentations. From what I said, the following presentation is going to be on the domestic side of the economy. How are you?
Yeah, I think that's 15. We're looking at very short presentations because obviously we've given you the documents and the discussion is much more important than. So it'll be about the presentations with probably half an hour. So I don't know whether you then want to look at it together and then we take all the questions, but we try to keep them very short. Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Governor, Honorable Chair, and the members of the committee. Once again, I apologize for the transport problems that I had. It was not entirely my own. Indeed, I think the presentation that the Governor has made is more interesting than the South African one. The improved outlook, the international outlook, augurs very well for South Africa's economic recovery. And the reason why I said probably this is very interesting is because the data release, particularly of output growth that is GDP will be released in about an hour. And therefore, the information that we're going to present is information that is relatively old that has been covered up in the corporate bulletin. Very quickly, the South African economy, that is the growth and output, set handsomely, as we know, in the third quarter of 2009. The figures will show up in the bioscope. This was due to positive growth in the real value added, as you know, of the secondary sector and tertiary sectors of the economy. We don't really do the projections or quarterly projections, but I think the indications and projections seem to indicate that the economy and the activity is recovering well in the first quarter of this year, supported by improved performance of all major sectors of the economy, that is the agricultural sector, the secondary sector of the economy, and also the tertiary sector. Data evidence seems to suggest that the same will be true for the last quarter and this first quarter. If consistent, that is the last quarter, this onset of recovery should confirm the bank's and also the recently revised National Treasury's growth forecast for the first quarter, which would be, in fact, for the year, which would be around 2% and 2.3%. On the expenditure side of the economy, the real gross domestic expenditure contracted at a slower pace in the third quarter, that is, that line was a little bit shorter than the first quarter, which suggests somewhat that there is an improvement, there was an improvement up in the third quarter. The demand side short-term indicators for the first quarter of this year suggest that there would be also an improvement on the domestic expenditure. Final consumption expenditure by household and disposal income, as the pillars show, that has contracted also at a slower pace, including the disposal income, which continued to decline. The economic contraction and declining employment levels in the formal sector of the economy contributed to the decline in the real disposal income of households in the third quarter. Again, the fourth quarter figures are not out. They will be out, published in the next quarterly bulletin. Looking at the service ratio, the household debt disposal income remained at elevated levels, that is still very high, and at the lower level or aggregate household debt in the third quarter caused the ratio of household debt or disposal income to edge slightly downward, but to a still high level of about 79% in the third quarter. The ratio of debt service cost to disposal income to household receded meaningfully, as that is the red line that I'm referring to, and that could be attributed to the decline in the interest rate over the past years. This was the lowest ratio, if I may say, recorded since the third quarter of 2006, again signaling somewhat a greater affordability of credit among households. Looking at the government consumption expenditure, that continued to trend higher, as you see the line, reflecting the continued expansion of government services in 2009 and the years beyond, as it was announced by the Minister of Finance last week. On the capital formation, which will be in the next graph, after a robust performance, as you've seen, since 2003, the fixed formation recorded a marginal decline in the second quarter and a contraction which was quite significant somewhat compared to where we come from since 2004 in the third quarter. This was again due to decline in capital economy. The real inventory levels is the next graph, which is showing quite a downward trend. Firms have continued to reduce their inventory levels. To our understanding, when firms face declining sales, they tend to economize on inventory accumulation, reflecting somewhat, as we know, the subdued economic conditions and sales volume. The next graph shows the leading and coincident business cycle indicators. Unfortunately, we didn't present that of the OECD leading indicators, and that leading business cycle indicator, which is the red one, shows almost a similar pattern and trend as that of the OECD countries, most of which have our major trading partners, suggesting that the economy is recovering somewhat. The blue line, which is the coincident leading indicator, in our view, appears to be bottoming out. The next graph shows the physical volume of the mining production. Mining production moved broadly sideways in the fourth quarter of last year, while the manufacturing production recovered somewhat further. Mining production, as you know, was adversely affected in July and August by mining accidents and strike action related to wage negotiations. Although production improved somewhat during the later part of the year, the industry remained under pressure due to persistent increases in operating costs and arguably the relative strength of the external value of the rand. So mining production in 2009 was down by about 6.7% compared with 2008. As I say, this is partly also due to the slump in international commodity prices then. The FNB, BER Consumer Confidence Index, is one of the indicators that we use to try and understand the confidence going forward for consumers. Consumer confidence picked up in the final quarter of 2009, alongside then an improved business confidence. The sub-index measuring consumers' rating of the appropriateness of the present time to buy durable goods recorded the largest improvement, and once again confirming the recent rise in confidence levels among retailers of durable goods surveyed in the fourth quarter. By the BER Retail Survey. The RMB BER Business Confidence is the slight next indicator, which rose slightly in the fourth quarter of 2009. This indicates that growing, although still small, number of respondents rated business conditions as satisfactory. During the survey period, confidence increased in the new vehicle sales, wholesale and retail trade sector. These improvements were partly offset by marginal decline in confidence level in the manufacturing and building sectors. The retail trade and constant prices in the fourth quarter increased up to December 2009, but still decreased when the fourth quarter is compared with the preceding quarter for 2009, but there is a little bit of a jump there. Time series is jumpy, so looking at month on month is not really a good thing. I think the governor, when I was coming here, sort of discussed slightly about the employment conditions domestically. I think the figures were out that the non-agricultural and the formal employment decreased in the third quarter. We don't have the fourth quarter figures, and as you see, the public sector employment levels which contracted temporarily in the first quarter of the year, in the third quarter it started to increase. But disappointing is indeed the employment in the private sector, which continues to show a somewhat a declining trend. Some 9,000 jobs were lost in the private sector during the third quarter. As most subsectors registered lower employment, with the exception of the gold mining, community, social and personal services, and the private transport. Wage settlements and consumer prices, wage settlements exceeded the upper limit of the inflation target in 2009, and as we know, according to Andrew Levy, the average wage settlement amounted to about 9.3% in 2009, slightly down from the 9.8% in 2008. The targeted consumer price inflation moderated from 11.3%, as you know, to an average, in, that is in 2008, to an average of 7.1% in 2009. Cost of labor per unit of output moderated somewhat. Decelerated in nominal wage growth in the formal non-agricultural sectors, together with improvements in productivity, resulted in a moderation in the rate of increase in the nominal unit labor cost, which averaged about 5.7%. On the external account, which will be the next gap, looking at the current account, preliminary data suggests that the trade surplus show that is those the last we have the fourth quarter figure, but that is still preliminary, but it shows that the trade surplus has widened somewhat, while the volume of both merchandise as imports and exports tick up somewhat. Early estimates suggest that the trade surplus widened further in the fourth quarter of 2009, adding to an overall surplus of about 2.3 billion for the entire year. The somewhat larger positive trade imbalance in the fourth quarter continued to be supported by the recovery in external demand, causing the volume of merchandise export to accelerate at a faster pace than that of merchandise imports. In addition, the export prices benefited from the surge in international commodity prices. Volume of merchandise imports decreased by 0.9% in the third quarter of 2009, and this was due to the decline in the volume of crude oil imports. Having declined for the three consecutive quarters, physical quantity of merchandise exports was up at 4.1%. On the financial account of the balance of payment, the net inflow of the financial account increased in the third quarter of 2009. The revival of capital flows most emerging market economies, as was highlighted, was also reflected in the financial account of the balance of payments of South Africa, which recorded an inflow to the total value of about 8.1 billion rands on the fourth quarter. On the foreign reserves, the next graph, South Africa, oh, it's not there, but South Africa's overall balance of payments remained in surplus through 2009. But the pace of reserve accumulation, which will be highlighted in the next presentation, decelerated somewhat. Money growth, money supply continued to slow down in 2009, and the deceleration in banks' total loans and advancement intensified in the fourth quarter of 2009. The weak money supply growth continued to reflect the current phase of the business cycle, characterized by a lower level of economic activity and subdued levels of household income and corporate profits. Contraction in the total loans and investments to the private sector intensified in the last 3 months. Well, despite the decline that we have seen in the repurchase rate, caution among the banks and subdued appetite for credit by both households and companies continue to have a dampening effect on lending. Mortgage advances, the only category in the total loans and advances category, recorded a positive level on the year-on-year growth. On the house prices, I think that's probably on the impaired loans, I'm sorry. The bank's impaired advances continue to rise in the recent months. As the governor probably have alluded in discussion, this is worrying very much for the Reserve Bank, where impaired advances indicator measures loans in respect of which credit impaired payments were raised. Expressed as a percentage of total gross loans and advances, impaired advances continue to increase in recent months, although at a slower pace, suggesting that the upward trend might be close to a leveling off. In December 2009, impaired advances amounted to about 6.1%, slightly up on the previous month. On the house prices started to recover recently. The effect of interest rate reduction since December 2008 is gradually, in our view, impacting in the South African housing market, as reflected by the recent reversal of the tide in domestic house prices. The last one would have been the fiscal balance. I don't think I should really get into that because that has been discussed quite extensively last week in the budget. My presentation would end there. I don't think that's good. Thank you very much.
Members of the committee, it's indeed a privilege and an honor to be with you again this morning, and also from my side, apologies for my slightly late arrival. My part of the presentation will cover developments in financial markets. The key themes that have recently influenced financial markets, both globally and here at home, pretty much touch on issues that the governor mentioned and my colleague as well, that apart from the general uncertainty about the strength of the global economic recovery, there have been issues about the deteriorating public finances in some of the Eurozone countries, concerns that some of the credit tightening measures that have been adopted in China might also negatively impact the fragile global economic recovery. There continues to be volatile investor sentiment and uncertainty about the impact of future regulatory measures for the banking and finance sector that are currently being contemplated. But overall, developments in the financial market and financial market conditions have certainly continued to improve from the very difficult period that we've come from. This graph here shows the difference between the international and South African interest rates, and we see that the gap remains relatively wide. We've used the interest rates in the United States as a proxy for international rates here, but if one were to look at the euro area, the UK, Japan, rates would be similarly at very low levels. Facing the recession and low inflationary environment, the Federal Reserve in the United States has maintained their target rates for the Fed funds at an exceptionally low level of between 0 and 0.25% over the past 14 months, with really no prospect of any change in the near term, notwithstanding last week's adjustment to the discount rate by the Federal Reserve, which is the rate that is used for obtaining emergency funding from the Fed, and not to be confused with the policy rate, which is the one depicted by the red line on the graph, the Fed funds target rate. We see from the graph that while the trend in rates was the same, South African interest rates followed the international trend with somewhat of a lag. As we just heard, the repurchase rate was lowered by 5 percentage points to 7% between December 2008 and August 2009, and has been kept unchanged since. The gap between these policy rates in part reflects the higher inflation experienced in South Africa. Looking at short-term interest rates, we can see that money market rates have been moving in tandem with the change in the repurchase rate. The yellowish line on the graph there depicts the rates on forward rate agreements, which are a contract that reflects the expectations of market participants for the likely path of future interest rates. These rates on forward rate agreements reflected both anticipated and actual reductions in the repo rate and other money market interest rates from December 2008 to around about the middle of last year. And currently, FRA do not signal expectations of significant interest rate changes, but rather reflect rates moving sideways. This slide shows the refinancing operations conducted by the South African Reserve Bank to manage domestic liquidity market conditions. The situation has been stable throughout the international financial crisis. As a result of this crisis, as the government has indicated, banks in a number of highly developed economy experienced severe liquidity problems and confidence was severely eroded and interbank markets became dysfunctional, which required central banks to step in and provide large amounts of liquidity to banks. And because of the fragile environment, most of these support measures remain in place, and there is ongoing debate about the appropriate timing and sequencing of the withdrawal of these measures. In South Africa, however, the banking system remains sound. There was no need for the South African Reserve Bank to extend special loans to banks or to step up its routine operations of providing liquidity to the banking sector. The interbank market was never disrupted, and the amount of accommodation provided to the banks has remained quite limited. As far as the turnover in the domestic bond market is concerned, 2009 was somewhat slower than 2008, both in terms of the value of bonds traded as well as with reference to the number of transactions. Although activity increased in the last 4 months of 2009, turnover in the secondary market of about 14.9 trillion in 2009 was about 13% lower than the value traded in the previous year, together with lower trading volumes and bond prices. One turns to the primary market. The activity in the primary bond market was mostly driven by public sector issuance on the back of increased funding needs of national government and state-owned enterprises. The infrastructure program and widening government deficits have resulted in a significant increase in issuance of bonds by the public sector since 2008, and this trend is set to continue given the projected size of the public sector borrowing requirement, as a member of the committee will be aware of. Domestic government bond yields increased during 2009 due to the higher level of supply I've just talked about. The daily average yield on the R157 government bond declined to 8.02% on the 9th of September based on lower inflation data release and the appreciated value of the rand. Subsequently, bond yields increased to 8.31% on the 2nd of February 2010, following the high level of issuance and expected future increase in the supply of government bonds. This particular bond is one that matures in three tranches starting from 2014. Another development on the JSE, although we've seen that the number of shares traded on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange was not affected very much by the global financial crisis and its spillover effect, the value of turnover was reduced significantly in late 2008 and into the early stages of 2009, which was a reflection of low share prices which prevailed at that time. We have seen a subsequent recovery in share prices, which was reflected in turnover values, although these continued to fall short and of the record turnover that would have been registered in October of 2008. Here's a comparison of share prices globally and South African share prices. Again, for the global situation, we are using a US index, the S&P 500, as an international benchmark, and we see that the share prices globally rose steadily in recent months as risk aversion subsided. As far as the All Share Price Index here at home is concerned, it increased by 48% by the 2nd of February this year from the most recent lowest point, which was about a year earlier, the 3rd of March 2009. The share prices were driven by strong international equity markets, and we can see on the graph there that it clearly shows how very closely the domestic market has been tracking the S&P 500. In addition, the higher commodity prices and lower interest rates were supportive, and this was amplified by the appreciation of the exchange rate of the rand, which then resulted in the all-share index, the South African all-share index, in US dollar terms, increasing by 107% from the recent low in March 2009 to 18th of February 2010. And with that increase, the local market outperformed the S&P 500 composite index, which increased by 64% over the same period in comparison. For 2009 as a whole, the all share index of the JSE was up by almost 30% in local currency terms, with the industrial and resource sectors having been particularly strong, and given the issues that we touched upon earlier, understandably the financial sector lagging somewhat behind. The balance of payment situation was briefly touched upon by Dr. Mjander. I would just like to give the committee some information on recent developments with regard to our foreign exchange reserves. The overall positive situation of balance of payments allowed us to continue increasing the foreign exchange reserves. So in US dollar terms, the value of the official gold and foreign exchange reserves decreased slightly by $39.5 billion at the end of January. We had seen a general increase during the year, though. And similarly, the international liquidity position, or net reserves, declined only marginally to $38.6 billion over the corresponding period. And I think it's important to state that these decreases were due to revaluation effects. The global financial market volatility resulted in fluctuating valuation adjustments in both US dollar and rand terms in recent months because of the diversified nature of our reserves. Looking at the turnover in the foreign exchange market, the South African foreign exchange market, what can be seen that having experienced a very severe collapse at the time or immediately in the aftermath of the collapse of Lehman Brothers, we have seen turnover recover somewhat, but certainly not going back to the levels seen previously, and I think this is pretty much in line with international development. The second last slide that I want to show you is about the exchange rate of the rand. The average exchange rate of the rand against the basket of currencies appreciated by 1.2% during the fourth quarter of 2009 and by about 23% for the year as a whole. And this rand appreciation in 2009 reversed pretty much to the same magnitude the sharp depreciation that we've seen in 2008. At that time, the nominal effective exchange rate during 2008 had actually depreciated by 23.5%. The appreciation of the domestic currency over 2009 was partly underpinned by a persistent rise in international commodity prices and an improvement in the country's external position, trade position. In addition, the positive data that we've seen on real GDP growth, the moderating inflation picture, as well as capital inflows, gave impetus to the exchange rate value during the fourth quarter of 2009. Since the end of the last year and until the middle of this month, the nominal effective exchange rate of the rand declined marginally. As far as the real effective exchange rate is concerned, there were similar marginal declines. The real effective exchange rate of the rand for the year 2009 increased also by around 30%. And finally, some few comments on non-resident investor interest in South African securities. After recording net sales of about $11.3 billion in September 2009, non-resident interest in the domestic listed bonds emerged in the fourth quarter of last year, leading to net brand. And this contributed towards net purchases of 15.5 billion in 2009, compared to net sales of 23.8 billion in 2008 of bonds. When looking at the share or equity side of it, we see that the purchases in that segment of the market really dropped the bond market purchases in 2009. The decline in global risk aversion encouraged non-resident interest in domestic shares, as reflected by consecutive net purchases pretty much from February onward, contributing towards a record high net purchase of some 75.3 billion in 2009, a figure which compares with net sales the previous year of 54 billion rand. So far this year, in 2010, until the end of last week, the net purchase of bonds and shares amounted to approximately 12 billion rand. I'll leave it at that and hand over to my colleague to take us through the next part of the presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. We will have privilege to the committee. I'll just give a brief overview of recent monetary policy developments, starting off with some of the price developments before going on to the monetary policy issues directly. Firstly, if we look at the consumer price index, we saw that throughout, for most of 2009, the index was in fact in negative territory. In other words, producer prices were falling in absolute terms, and this was a result of the declining commodity prices primarily. We saw, as a result of the crisis, international oil prices declining, various other commodities, platinum, etc., and also a lot of the agricultural commodity prices were falling as well. By the end of 2009, we started seeing a small uptick in the producer price index, again back in positive territory, partly again because of the recovery in some of these commodity prices, but also because of the increase in electricity prices that had been recorded in the economy. Looking at the targeted measure of inflation, that is headline CPI, we saw that in November, December, the CPI index had come back towards the upper end of the target. It came within the target and then has gone up again very slightly. But our forecast, as we can see on that dotted line, is that CPI inflation should remain within the target range, get back within the next month or so, and remain within the target for the rest of our forecast period, which goes to the end of 2011. But we can also see that the expectation is that although we'll be within the target range of 3-6%, we'll be very close to the upper bound. We expect to be at a level of about 5.5% by the end of the forecast period. A couple of important developments within the CPI basket. The food prices, which were a major source of upward pressure on CPI during 2008 and the early part of 2009, have now become a downward factor where food prices are now lower than the average CPI, so they are putting downward pressure on overall CPI, and the outlook is positive there from an inflation point of view. Also, petrol prices were highly negative during 2009 because of the decline in the petrol prices and the international oil prices during that year. But now that that decline has come out of the base, we're starting to see positive contributions coming through from petrol prices. So the downward pressure coming from petrol prices will no longer be there. Looking at the administered prices, if we look at the overall administered price index, that is the red line, we see that the overall index is around 9%. It has come down to fairly low levels, but that is primarily because of the impact
of the lower petrol prices. If we exclude the petrol prices, we have the green line where we see that administered prices generally have been fluctuating between the 9% and 12-13% level. And a big component of that, of course, is the electricity price increases, which were around 27% in recent months. Moving on to the actual Monetary Policy Committee decisions, in the last meeting, the last few meetings, the repo rate has been left unchanged at 7%. If we look at the blue line here, shows us the actual decline in the repo rate by 500 basis points during the last year. In terms of the real interest rate, the real purchase rate, we can see for the last year or so, real interest rates have been extremely low, at the lowest levels, well, on this graph, but in, historically also for quite some time, given that the nominal repo is at 7% and inflation expectations are around 6%, gives us a real repo rate of about 1%. Just to summarize some of the main points that were highlighted in our recent MPC statement. Firstly, on the demand side, it was argued that inflation pressures have been persistently weak, and from our perspective, these pose no significant upside risk to the inflation outlook. And we felt that noted that household consumption expenditure was expected to remain subdued for various factors. One of them is the high levels of unemployment that we've seen. It's not only the unemployment that is of concern, it's also job insecurity or expected unemployment, which affects decisions by households to consume or not. We also saw the weak wealth effects, although these aren't as bad as they were a few months back when the stock exchange was at very low levels and house prices were falling. As we saw in the earlier presentation, house prices have reached their lower turning point and in some instances are showing some positive growth. The stock market has recovered off its lows, but it's still a lot of uncertainty about the outlook. We also noted the high household debt levels, which also would impact on the ability or on decisions of households to spend. And finally, that we saw that credit extension was very low, and part of that is not only a demand story, but also very tight credit criteria that were applied by banks. So even those households that may have wanted to increase their expenditure may have been constrained by lack of access to credit. On the growth side, we noted an improved growth outlook, but as we know, that growth is expected to remain below potential. As we mentioned earlier on, our forecast for 2010 is a growth rate of around 2%, and with the potential growth much higher than that, we do see very few inflationary pressures coming from there. The global environment also remains fairly benign from an inflation perspective. Global inflation is extremely low, so we don't expect to import inflation from the global sources. International oil prices have risen from their lows at the end of 2008. In fact, they've doubled since then, but they're still about half the levels they were earlier on. International oil prices appear to have stabilized in the last couple of months in levels between $70 and $80 per barrel. Although we have assumed a slightly higher oil price over time, this will depend to a large extent on developments in the global economy. If the global economy remains weak, we could see some oil prices remaining fairly subdued at these levels or even some downside movement, but should the global recovery surprise on the upside, we could see much higher oil prices. The outlook for food inflation, as I mentioned before, this has become
a good news part of the CPI index. In the past few weeks, we've seen a significant decline in some of the maize prices, in white maize in particular. And so although there is some upward pressure on food prices in international markets, we don't expect to see very strong food inflation coming through in the next few months. The exchange rate, again, we see as having remained a positive factor from an inflation perspective. And also the other important aspect from our perspective is what is happening on the wage front. Although, as we noted in the statement, that wage settlements are still in excess of inflation, they have been declining in nominal terms, and we expect that trend to continue over the next few months, given the high levels of unemployment and the slowly recovering economy. Electricity prices ultimately remain the single biggest risk to the inflation outlook. We had assumed in our forecast an increase in electricity prices of 25% over the coming 2 years. Now, the risk to our outlook does come from there in the sense that if NERSA decides to, and I think the decision is being made, is it today, I think, tomorrow, if NERSA gives a much higher increase, then it will put an upward bias to our forecast. And there's also a risk that we haven't adequately captured the second round effects of these increases in our forecasting model. We also noted that inflation is likely to remain close to the upper end of the target range, even though it is within the target band. And generally, our view was that the risks to this outlook were fairly evenly balanced. In other words, we thought there was as much chance of being above the forecast as below. But given the closeness of the forecast to the upper end of the target range, it was decided at that point to keep the repurchase rate unchanged at 7% per annum. I think I'll leave it there, Chair.
Thank you. Governor, do you have anything to say before?
I'm quite happy to open for printing more copies.
Yeah, this is a very comprehensive presentation. In the main, I think we've covered four areas. The economic framework, globally and domestically, and the third area is the financial market, and the monetary policy development, which is the last presentation. I'm going to propose colleagues that we take a 5-minute tea break so that you can align your thoughts on how to deal with this presentation. Agreed? Thank you.